the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. Now from the Nowcast Network Studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here to my right, we've got Scott Gershon.
Hi, Mike.
Across the table, we've got Andrew Sheps.
Hi, Mike.
And right next to Andrew, we've got Rob Arbatier.
It's good to be here for a change, Mike.
And today we've got a really special guest. We've got a great show. With us today from Mojave Audio is Dusty Wakeman. Dusty, welcome to the Audio Nowcast.
Hi, folks. Good to be here.
Now, later on, we're going to talk about the Mojave microphones because, well, as Andrew will tell you, they're just phenomenal microphones.
Yep.
And so we'll talk a little bit about that, and we'll find out the story and talk about their website because it's really cool. But before we talk about that, I want to bring up a couple things, guys. First of all, I got to tell you a story.
Tell us a story, Mike.
I went to Guitar Center to buy a piece of gear, okay? Now, sometimes you just have to go to Guitar Center because they're the only ones that have the gear. And I wanted to get a Korg, one of their drum machines, one of their little tribal boxes.
Electribe things?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so I was looking forward to going over there. I was looking forward to getting it. And I went to the one over in Hollywood. And right when I got there, this guy goes and he starts demoing the gear. So I thought, oh, that's okay. I love him demo. And I'm kind of looking at other stuff. And I actually go right next to him and I'm just kind of waiting, kind of patiently, kind of, you know, fiddling around with some of the other gear. And he's still there. And so, you know, in their demos, you can listen to more than one thing coming through the mixer at a time. And so I'm on another Korg gear, and I'm trying to be really kind of courteous and not make too much noise, you know, because I know he's demoing that gear, and he's still there. So finally I thought, well, you know, I'm going to go, and I'm going to try and play some keyboards and, you know, see what's out there and what's the latest and greatest in keyboards. So I go to the keyboards, and I find a couple different keyboards, and I'm playing the keyboards, and every once in a while, I glance back to see if I can go and try the Electric Tribe, and he's still there. I'm like, oh my gosh, what's this guy doing? And you know, if you've been to Guitar Center in Hollywood, they have a huge keyboard area. And so I start at one end and I just play my way all the way down to the other side. And this guy is still there.
The guy was a customer or a salesman?
No, he was homeless.
He was a customer, and he was still there doing, you know, if you know the Electric Tribe.
Electribe. Get it right.
Electribe. Sorry.
No, that's right.
See? I don't know. I didn't get to say it.
You didn't get close enough to read it.
So the guy is still there, and he's just a customer, and I go into the Pro Audio section because then I want to see, okay, well, what's the latest in Pro Audio that they got? So I go in there and I see what they're, oh, they picked up a couple new lines, and I'm looking at the DJ stuff. and you know, you've been there a while when you start looking at like, wow, that's a really great horn on that PA cabinet. And the guy is still there. And by now it's been like 45 minutes. And now it's like, well, I just got to see how long this is going to be because now I'm determined to finally play the Electribe and finally get my hands on it, right?
It doesn't even do that many different things. What could it be doing for 45 minutes?
A record.
I have no idea.
He had a little flash drive plugged in there. Yeah, walked out.
So finally what I did is the great thing about Guitar Center in Hollywood is they have the that vintage room. I mean, I went down to acoustic guitars. I mean, I was stretching, right? And so I go into the vintage room. And by the way, some of those guitars in the vintage room, that's like phenomenal. I mean, the prices are just amazing, you know, $79,000 for a guitar from like the 50s. Anyhow.
But you digress.
Yeah. But I came back and the guy is still there. I was in Guitar Center for an hour and he was on the same piece of gear for an hour. Finally, after an hour, I go back up. He's not at the Electribe anymore. No, he's moved to the next one. And he starts playing that one. Because there's that blue one and there's the red one. And I'm like, Oh my gosh, I could not believe it. It was at that moment that I made a note to tell this story in the podcast. I could not believe the guy was going on to hour two. You know, he's going into a second hour because he moved over to the next piece of gear. I was getting angry and I wanted to tell somebody to tell him to get out of here so that, you know, people who are going to buy something, you know, can
well,
come
imagine if, he was trying to learn the Oasis or something that's actually pretty complicated. I mean, the Electrab stuff, it's pretty basic.
And it brought a couple things to mind that I wanted to talk to you guys about. Number one, obviously, I really couldn't, you know, get violent in Guitar Center. You know, that didn't give me a good excuse to like smack him on the head with a keyboard stand. But like, A, if people are out there and you're demoing gear, well, how do you demo gear? I mean, I have no idea what this guy was doing. You know, I mean, I know when I get in there within the first, 5 minutes, I can tell if I like a piece of gear or not, you know, cause you do some homework. I mean, like Rob, when you go demo a piece of gear, what's your process?
My process is by the time I go to see it in a store, I've already researched it on the web. I've talked to people who have it if I know anybody. And usually when I go to the store, it's just to pick it up. It's not to, not to try it. I mean, so, I might try it for 5 minutes to see if it feels cool, but.
And do you ever stumble on like try something out? Just like, oh, I've never seen this before or whatever. And just.
Yeah, all the time, which is why I try to stay out of the stores. It gets expensive after a while.
I mean, Andrew, what's your process when you demo a piece of gear?
Well, for me, for recording gear, it's usually I actually will get one to demo in a session.
Right.
Like, there's no point in me going to a store and like putting on, that's like the thing at NAMM that's crazy is walking around and putting on headphones to listen to a microphone. Yeah. You're like, well, it's silly.
Yeah.
It's silly. But, when I was doing a lot more programming, I think it was, it was a lot more word of mouth and I'd just be going to pick it up. You know, I would find out about things because I'd hear something on a track like a friend had done, like, man, what's that? And you go, oh, dude, that's the Electribe. And like, okay, you gotta have one and you save up and you actually just go get it. I mean, we've had this conversation before. I can't stand going into Guitar Center.
Yeah. I'm amazed the way you look forward to it.
Well, you know, every once
that's
in a while.
Like hell on earth to me.
Actually, I got a Chaosolator out of the deal. See, I did buy something on the way out. I bought a Chaosolator and I wanted one of those for a while.
That's pretty cool.
But, here's the thing. And I just want to give people some advice out there. When you go demo something, I think the first thing you should look for is you should do your homework on the web. Okay. So do your homework on the web, kind of get an idea of what you want. But then go in with a plan. Just don't sit there so you don't piss somebody else off.
Well, or at least look around every once in a while.
It's like, I couldn't believe it. I mean, I think, you know, like when I demo gear, when I go into Guitar Center to demo some gear, the very first thing I look for is even before I touch anything, I look at the user interface because I want to see how easy it is to get to certain pages and if it makes sense. You know, can you go into global mode? Can you change this? Can you change that? You know, how easy it is to set your MIDI channels and how easy is it to get into the guts. And once you're there, you know, that's half the battle.
Yeah, well, you're just confirming stuff you think you already know.
Exactly.
And
but,
that's it.
But every once in a while, I'll go in to play a keyboard and it sounds really great. It sounds really great. And you get there and it's like, oh my God, like how can you possibly work your way around it? I mean, a good example is that one keyboard we always talk about that you have, Rob.
Which one?
The one where you, have to change sequences to change patches or
Mono Machine.
Yeah. So,
the Electron Mono Machine, the world's most difficult to operate synth.
I don't know. Exactly.
It really is.
I mean, I think people just need to have a plan when they go in there. So
you also have to do your research because if you go in there expecting that you're going to find a salesman who's an expert in the particular piece of gear that you're hoping to learn about.
No.
Well, here's what you want to do. Especially, in fact, anybody who wants to buy gear or try out gear, the plan is you want to go in there having an appointment with somebody or having spoken to somebody. Because the guy that knows how to work that, he's off taking care of stuff.
That's
he's
right.
not
he's
prowling
busy.
The floor. You're getting the new guy that's prowling the floor. So if you go in there and you're meeting with the pro audio guy or the keyboard guy or whoever it is, you know, and there's some guy that's a looky-loo, he's going to move that looky-loo right along. Excuse me, we need to get to this because I've got a demo to do.
So, Scott, you used to work at Guitar Center. Did you ever have people that just came into the
I
store
the fifth,
and, like, set up camp and just demoed, stayed on a piece of gear for hours at a time?
Besides you?
I was going to say, that pretty much that describes me, actually. Yeah, I mean, it depends on if they were real or if they were students or if they were, you know, what they were trying to accomplish. I think people kind of do need to get an opportunity to play with the gear. But you're talking about hogging it. Most of them were guys with guitars and Marshalls and cranking up really loud, and you get to hear them play guitar over and over.
But I'm talking about
if we're talking about a drum machine and a dude who's on there for an hour.
Yeah.
I think
that's like,
I mean, that's,
yeah, no.
That's a little ridiculous, especially when I had the cash right then to go buy that piece of gear, and I didn't buy it, by the way.
Well, no, usually, I mean, I worked there like a whole 3 months. I just worked there long enough to buy some gear. but I mean, usually, though, if there was a client who really wanted to, like, you knew they were ready to buy, you would then, as politely as possible, ask the person who's camped out there to stop camping out there because you need to show somebody that piece of gear. Or it's getting too loud, it's getting too obnoxious, being distracting for everybody, everyone's losing their minds, and then you ask – either give them some headphones and say, knock yourself out, but you just can't dominate the store.
Yeah, well, this guy dominated
and pissed me off. And to be completely honest, whenever I want to demo anything, I go to Rob's because he's already bought it.
Yeah, exactly.
You know he's already
just
got
so
one.
Much easier.
All right, well.
I will say this about demoing stuff, though. This is pretty funny. You know, we've talked about it before, how at the NAMM show, I always walk Stevie around and show him, you know, whatever the new stuff is.
Right.
And actually, Dusty... I made the NAMM show a little crazy for Dusty this year too, because Stevie had some friends who had to get in, and Mojave was nice enough to help us with all that, and it was just a crazy time. And Stevie, of course, wanted to demo the Mojave mics in the booth, you know, in an incredibly loud environment. Although he fell in love with them right away.
He stayed there
with
a
the
long
headphones
time,
on.
Singing
yeah,
on it.
Singing on it with headphones on. But what I was going to say in this story, you know, you talk about people demoing gear and hogging gear. One of the things I do when I'm walking Stevie around the NAMM show is, if I have him at a booth where he's having fun, I'll then run to what I think is the next place we want to go to is, and just get them ready. You know, I'll say, listen, I'm bringing Stevie by here in like 3 minutes. So you have something you want to show him, let me know.
You know what? I'm going to have Rob go to Guitar Center before I get there.
No, but it doesn't always work.
But you know what I do find is even smaller stores than like places like a GC, and that is if you become friends with the owners, the managers, key people there, you buy a lot of stuff there, and you are their client, a lot of times what you'll do is something will come out and you're going to go, look, I just need to hear it in my place. And a lot of times they'll be more than happy to let you take it for a day or two or even that day. And, you know, because they know you, you're a customer who's been there all the time.
Well, it's good business for them to do
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's all about that relationship.
Yeah.
All right, well.
Especially with microphone and speakers, yeah.
Let me just finish this NAMM story because it was actually pretty funny.
Go ahead.
So normally I would run ahead to a booth and I would tell him Stevie's coming and he wants to check out the gear, and they'd usually get excited and, you know, set up a demo or whatever. There have been a few times where somebody else will just walk up to the gear and start demoing it. Even though everyone from the company is getting ready for Stevie, just some normal, you know, person from the show will walk up to it. That happened this year. I forget what keyboard company it was, but they had basically cleared out the booth and they were ready to show Stevie their new stuff, whatever it was. And we got there and there was a guy, like a middle-aged guy, sitting there playing the piano sound. And he didn't see us come up behind him. And Stevie, I know him well enough to know he never, ever wants to interrupt somebody. He never pulls any kind of rank. He's just a really nice guy.
Right.
So I would never interrupt somebody if I'm standing with Stevie because it's just rude and he doesn't ever play those power trip kind of games. But so we were standing behind this guy and he was demoing the piano. And so I was standing right behind him. Stevie was standing next to me and like 1,000 people had followed us from the previous booth. This guy is sitting in his own world demoing the piano sound. He takes off the headphones and he turned around and he was right in Stevie's face. I mean, he turned around and Stevie Wonder was like, you know, a foot away from him and 1,000 people.
It's like the Verizon commercial.
But when he stood up, to get off of the little piano riser, everybody started clapping and screaming because Stevie was going to be stepping up there. But this guy looked like he was going to have a heart attack. He thought he was in his own world just playing this thing with the headphones on. I thought that was so funny. And I actually would have been doing him a favor if I had interrupted him because it was such a shock.
That's pretty
but,
funny.
But, you know, we've had it happen in a store where somebody will be hogging a piece of gear and Stevie will just stand there patiently. Well, it has never been for an hour. But
how could you demo anything at GC, though?
Well... You can.
You can, like maybe at 11 in the morning.
You can get enough. You know what? Yeah, well, you can get enough to get a flavor. I mean, if you, like, I know how to, I've demoed so much gear. I can get in. I can tell if it does what I need it to do, and I can get out.
I think they need to have their own room for, I'm a guitar player too, but they need to have the guitar room with just, you know, a small room with lots of Marshalls in it where people can just blow their brains out.
I think some of them are laid out better for that.
Some of them do. Yeah. Some of them do have their, anyhow, well, that's a whole lot basically just to say when you go into Guitar Center or any music store, just look around and see if other people are trying to demo gear along with you.
Or just see if Mike is there. He's the only one who complains
Mike,
about it.
Excuse me, Mike. Get them off.
Yeah. Anyhow. All right. Well, I wanted to, you know, bring that up because that was just really bugging me. Other thing I want to talk about is, guys, I'm keeping one of my New Year's resolutions. And I don't know if you remember, but on the last show of the year.
A new set of fishnets?
No, I said I was starting a band. Oh. And I'm starting a band. And I've actually.
Wow.
I've the actually.
FM or AM? But I'm a little radio humor. It's the hay fever talk.
I was going to try and let you skate by.
I laid that out there. That was for the world right there. Send your thank you notes to our email address.
But I wanted to bring this up because I haven't had to deal with the whole starting a band thing in years. And I got a drummer and got a guitar player and working on getting another keyboard player. And so I started looking for a singer, and I put an ad out in Craigslist, you know, female singer wanted. And I listed Frou Frou and Sade because I want a real smooth singer. It's kind of an ambient electronic project that we're working on. And man, I just got flooded with responses just off that. I didn't give any information. There's a lot of people that are hungry to be in a band. And so I had to come up with a process to filter everything down so I could only get people that were really interested in the project that I was doing.
Were they sending you recordings or MySpace links?
This is just first. This is a total just reply to your Craigslist. So it's just, it's, hey, we saw your ad in Craigslist. I'm really interested. Because then what you have to do is, A, you get the responses back and you can make one round of cuts just on your replies. Like, first of all, if you're out there and you think you might want to be in a band and somebody puts an ad out, don't just reply with the link. It's just like, you know, I would get people who would just send me a link to their website or a link to their MySpace.
And this is all
page.
In California, all over the world.
No, this isn't California. This is actually all in LA and Orange County. That's where I put the ad at. I must have gotten 30, 40 hits.
I don't think it's that weird to get a link, actually. I mean, that's gonna tell you everything you need to know.
Yeah, but here's
about
the thing. The thing with it was just so, it's not personal. It's just, you know, it just doesn't make it, when you get people that, hey, I'm really interested in your, and what you're doing, tell me a little bit more. I really like the singers, or I've always admired Sade for her voice, or I've always tried to, you know, just.
You're going to end up finding someone really chatty.
Yeah. No, but you just want somebody who wants to be, you know, I just want someone who has a little passion.
Motivated.
Who's a little motivated. And so I did a second round where what I did is I wrote a couple little pieces of music of kind of the style that I wanted to do, and I put it up on my MySpace page just so that they had an idea of where it was going, so that they knew, oh, this is electronic ambient, I hate that music, or it's not country, I hate that music, or, you know, whatever. And so, you know, and that does another round of cuts. And then the people that come back and say, hey, I really like that, you know, I have some ideas and yada, yada, yada. And so now I've set up some appointments where they're going to come actually to the studio and we're going to talk, and, you know, I sent them MP3s and they're going to come back to see what kind of vocal stuff they've done on it. But, it made me think that this was so different than years gone by when I used to, you know, you put an ad in like the Recycler and you get the phone calls and I don't know. I just wanted to open it up. Do you guys have any, really good advice on how to A, pick a singer, and B, just to weed out the wannabes and weed out the people through this whole process? Because I'm sure I'm not the only one out there listening to the podcast who's starting a band or who wants to be in a band. And I just wanted to open it up for some advice, from you guys about,
I mean, I'd be really ultra selective. about who you're setting up those meetings with.
Yeah.
And where you're having them.
And where you're having them, absolutely. Well,
or just make sure that, like, you know, Chris Hansen from NBC is there or something. So, in case things go funny.
I'll tell you the weird thing. Number one, you know, it works both ways. There's the whole security. It's funny you say that because I was really concerned about the security, not necessarily for myself, because the building that I'm in is where the studio is. It's really secure, and once I leave, I would never
bring him to the studio. Are you kidding?
No, I'd meet him in some neutral
cafe,
Starbucks,
coffee shop. Yeah, you don't bring him to the studio. Are you kidding?
No, of course I'm not, because this is where we're going to be working, and I want to get this thing going.
Once you find out who the singer is,
yeah,
anybody can
show up with their boyfriends.
Yeah. It's also safer for them too. I mean, because some of them might not want to go to a studio.
Exactly. That's the whole thing. It was really weird because I'm looking specifically for a female vocalist, and so I just had to think, well, you know, who's going to want to come to a studio at night that they don't know? And so a couple of people that I've set up the appointments with. First of all the communication has come. Has disseminated for me to them. I haven't asked for phone numbers or anything like that. Because it's just, you want to put them at ease that, you know, they're not, you know, going
and you're
over
not,
some.
You're not using that at axemurderer.com email address anymore.
I don't know, but you really, I don't know. I have no problem meeting them in the studio. I mean, I bring clients all the time that I've met.
They're not clients.
They're not
though.
Clients. You don't know who they are and you don't know who they're bringing.
No, I agree.
I do remember when I was younger, when I first came out, someone did something like that, and a bunch of guys came with guns and cleaned them out, took everything.
Well, if they come clean me out, they better bring some wire cutters.
They got those.
I don't know, because if I meet them in a cafe, and then you have to go another round.
Well, but you know what,
I want to hear them sing. That's my main thing.
Well, but if... You can meet them somewhere close to the studio, and because a huge part of someone being in a band is that you get along with them too. So there's a whole social interaction part of the process that needs to happen, and it might as well happen first.
But when you get a CD, though, I mean, you say, "Hey, listen,
managed to record stuff, I mean, you know, you wouldn't want to narrow it down to people who've only been able to record demos in a style that's relevant.
Well, that's the whole thing. It's like, you know, I'm actually – the person I'm looking for, it doesn't have to be professional. It can be somebody who's always wanted to sing. It's more of a project thing. I think starting a band is really a little bit, you know, more ambitious than what actually I want to do is I want to do a project and record about 8 or 9 songs and then just see what happens and see where it goes from there. I think the problem is with a lot of young groups is we're going to form a band and we're going to record. We're going to go on tour.
But you did Craigslist. A lot of times most people that I know when they create bands – they go to all their friends that are musicians and friends that are friends, and they put the word out saying, "Hey, look, I'm looking for a blah blah. Does anybody know anyone?"
Yeah, use your personal network, or go to places like Musicians Institute or places or music schools that are more targeted.
Well, I would think in this day and age, you wouldn't really want to work with somebody that couldn't at least send you a sample of, you know, that's been on a microphone and recorded a little clip before. Because otherwise, you're just starting from ground
unless
zero.
You're friend, unless you're a friend.
Like, this is
like
a microphone.
Vibe.
Okay, stand in front of it. We're going to put the headphones on. You don't
but you know what?
Do I'm, all that work.
Well,
especially in Los Angeles, there's thousands of singers out there.
Well,
that
see,
can,
but I think I've whittled away through the correspondence and the phone calls. I think I've tossed a lot of – because you're absolutely right. There are a lot of people that – think that they're stars. Oh my gosh, I should show you some of the stuff afterwards.
I've got boxes and boxes full of it.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. You
know, I mean, is there any rehearsal space that you can just...
Well, it's too late. I've got 3 coming this week. And
have someone else here.
Well, that I will. I'm going to have another. I'm going to be here by myself.
If you're not here in 2 weeks, who should we get for the podcast?
No, I don't know.
Do you have one of those panic codes on your alarm?
No, just make sure someone else is here.
Wow, you guys, you know, I wasn't freaked out before.
You know, I mean, the percentage of
I understand
people who would be doing this is pretty small, but it only takes one.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, especially with music, because that means there's gear. Like, there has to be some gear. And it's just something to think about. It's not like you got to be, you know.
Okay, I got to make some phone calls right now.
It's good to be aware.
And then they're going to ask you the questions like, well, what do you do? Oh, I'm a mixer. Really? And what do you do? I do this, this, and this. They're like, really?
And my PIN number is.
And they're like, ah, okay.
Well, okay, I could be totally wrong, and if I'm not here in 2 weeks and I am, then you know what happened. But I think I've made some pretty smart selections. I think from talking and from corresponding, and I mean, you got to go and I totally can hear what you guys are saying. And
Bubba on the other side.
Yeah.
You know?
But you've actually talked to them on the phone.
I've talked to them on the phone. I've done a little screening, and the only thing I didn't do was set up the Starbucks, because as far as I'm concerned, I want to get the word.
Can you Skype them?
I'm sorry.
Skype. Video conference?
No, I know. I'm just kidding. It just sounds so wrong. No, I mean, it's all, I've already set them up. So they're coming. So I just got to make sure that I call my brother and my dad and my best friend.
Do you have a big dog?
Bring a dog and my robotic dinosaur and just make sure everybody's here.
Well, it's good that your studio is a secure place. It's not like...
It's totally secure. And you know, even if they came in and they wanted everything, they can't get it. And it's I don't know. I feel really
Are they coming here?
Comfortable. Yeah.
Those I would, the people here, but for the future, though, I would do the Starbucks thing or something like that. I really would.
Well, you go to the Starbucks, because they can, you know what? They could go in, they could be just totally cool, and they could be totally cool at Starbucks, and then you go, okay, let's go to the studio, and you can still get.
True. That's true.
Yeah, but you get
you
a
could
vibe.
Also weed them out, you get a vibe, yeah.
Well, I think I got the vibe on the phone. But that's a, you know what? We'll see.
Well, you asked for our advice.
That's right.
You got it.
Wow, last time I did
that. Paranoid dudes.
Yeah. So next question.
I think you're smart, though. I think you're smart. I mean, I don't know. Anybody, when was the last time anybody started a band here? Anybody ever playing a band? Anybody?
1,000 bands.
Okay. I mean, how did some of the bands that you've played in Dusty, how did they go together?
It was all people that knew people.
Yeah. Right? Same thing here.
Always. I never worked with somebody who was a stranger.
When
I first came out, I was auditioning for different bands.
Right.
There were ads, there were rehearsal spaces. And it was a rehearsal space where there were 200 bands or, you know, the ones you rent anywhere, they get them. They come in and they got people waiting and they go, here's a song, here's the lyrics, we'll play it for you, sing it, play it, guitar, whatever.
Now let me ask you guys a question. What do you think are some of the important things when you start a band to get totally out in the open as soon as you start? I mean, expectations?
Will you sleep with
ambitions. Yeah. Absolutely, ambitions and that your personality is shown enough that you're hoping they're showing their personality. Because if you don't get along with them, it doesn't matter how good they are. It's
right.
going to suck. Unless, right. you know, you're immediately making so much money that who cares?
Right.
You can all have your own bus. Tour, you know?
Yeah, it's not
But ambitions, too, I think is a huge thing to know.
Why are you doing this?
Yeah, what's the point of doing it? Because you're doing it mostly to make some music and have fun. You're not thinking, you know, and this time next year, we're all going to be billionaires.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that's not the point. If that happens, great. But
exactly.
I think those are the two most important parts of working with anybody in a creative environment where you're committing to it. You know, it's not like, yeah, we're just going to do a song together. You're talking infinitely long term if it works out.
Yeah, I've never put together a band that I was in. I've actually put together bands for other artists, and I've been in bands, but not bands that I actually put together. And it's amazing what a personality conflict will do. And I mean, every rockumentary you've ever seen about bands fighting is completely true. It's amazing how evil it gets.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, I definitely think the personality thing is a heavy thing. I think right off at the very beginning, I want to, talk about expectations and be really upfront with all that.
And well, if you find this singer and you have some breakout, you know, record that gets a lot of airplay, you know, in Europe, are they going to be willing to get on a plane and go promote that? Or they're like, oh, I don't want to do that. I just wanted to sing.
Yeah, you got to know up front.
Yeah. So do you have like compatible lifestyles?
Yeah, that's definitely something to talk about.
I worked with a band once and hooked them up with the manager, and it was a band I developed. I wasn't playing with them, but I produced them. But I knew the drummer. I recorded an album with them. I hooked them up with a manager, who went out and got them a lot of record airplay. But the singer was a school teacher, and when it was time to okay, well, you know, we're going on tour. It's like, I can't go on tour. I'm a school teacher. And everybody just kind of looked at each other like, we should have talked about this. It's okay. Well, guys, it's been great. Thanks. See ya. Guess we're done here.
Yeah, well, that's true. You definitely got to talk about expectations and what happens if things do work out. I think the other thing that I think is really important when you're starting a band, and these are some of the things I was thinking about, was a definite, for lack of a better word, chain of command, you know.
Absolutely.
I just think ownership.
The question is, why are you starting the band is the first thing you've got to ask. Is it because you've written some music, you got some ideas you want to put out there, and you want other musicians to play it, and, you know, or is it that you're looking to collaborate with another musician to write things? Are you not a composer but want to be a player and get a good couple writers in? What are the dynamics?
Rich. Just want to be rich.
Well, you're in the right business, pal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, you know
you're
what?
In the right town, in the right business.
The reason why I want to start a band is because, you know, I've written a lot of music, and I've never taken that next step. I've never actually gone and recorded, and I want to be in a situation where I can collaborate with some people and do some music and have a record. It's just one of those things that I want to do. And now's the time.
So you haven't suffered enough.
Like, I know early on, I used to have something called the Phoenix Project. And I used to always have different players, different people, and try them out. But everybody knew there was a goal. You know, I had some songs, and someone said, well, I get some songs too. Yeah, let's throw those in too. And then there was a goal involved. We want to try to come up with tunes, record it. Done.
Well, I'll tell you what, the goal is 9 songs. It's 9 songs. And right now, that's about as far as.
So you want to get the musicians, rehearse it, work out the parts,
record it, and then that's it. Do 9 songs. And then we'll see what happens after that. At the end of 9 songs, if we put out the CD and we're happy with it and things, you know, worked out, then we'll go on to number 2.
Now, here's the big question. If you're writing as you go and they're not being paid,
oh no! It's total. You have to.
You got to pay them at least a buck.
Well, you know, you got to put them in. They got to have co-ownership if they put in the if they help write. If you collaborate, you just got to. I have no problem splitting. That's, you know, I'm not egotistical and thinking that I have to.
Well,
because
you said
you've
had your songs. So.
Well, yeah, but you know, they're ideas, and if they come in and like if the singer who I'm looking for can really generate a great melody, I mean, melodies are just as important as the music.
50%.
Exactly, and I think you got to set yourself up for success, and one of the ways to set yourself up for success, and I'm not talking about success in as far as music, I'm just talking about success as far as getting along with people, is being fair, you know, and just like, you know, if they're going to come in there and put in, you know, hard work and come up with melodies and half the song or whatever part of the song, they deserve a cut too. And I think if you work with that kind of idea in mind, you're going to avoid a lot of problems that I'm sure, Dusty, working in a studio, you've probably seen some major fights with people about all this stuff.
Absolutely.
You know?
Well,
it's always fights over the money that doesn't exist. It's over the publishing or the points or something like that. It's never about the advance. Like, that's been split up and everybody's cool with the cash they got. But it's always about the money they haven't made, and it usually keeps them from making it.
Yeah.
Well, plus in this day and age, there really are no more advances. So that's nothing to fight over anymore.
Yeah.
It's all about the back end.
Yeah, and I just think if I go into this, you know, don't be greedy. If you're out there, if you're going to start a band, just don't be greedy. Don't start, you know, don't count your chickens before they hatch.
Well, they're
so this isn't really a band. This is more of a project.
Yeah, it is a project.
It's definitely a project.
It could turn into a band.
It could turn into a band.
See, I don't really believe in bands for anybody over past like 22 years old.
Yeah.
Because a band is a bunch of people that can get in a van and, you know, go to another town and play a show. You know, that would be a loose definition of a band. Anything less than that is kind of a project or collaboration.
It's a project.
There you go.
It's a collaboration.
Right. Okay.
That could turn into something more.
Good. I'm glad we've got that clear.
Thank you, Dusty. But there are plenty of examples of huge bands that just split their writing to eliminate the fight.
Yeah. Grateful Dead being.
Yeah.
Radiohead, same way.
Yeah. That definitely is a
part
of the work.
And whatever it is, as long as you have it up front, you were asking what to do up front, that's a big one. And just, you know, get that out of the way.
And that's true. Even if you're just writing with another person, even if it's not an official project or a band or anything, you should always start the process by talking about what the split is, or loosely at least discuss.
Yeah, and
what
hopefully you'll get somebody who will actually be motivated by the fact that you're cutting them in and really want to earn it, as opposed to getting to the end of it feeling like I did all this stuff and I'm getting what?
Yeah.
Well, and then the question: who? Because you don't have a publisher at that point, who would get the publishing? I love to ask these questions.
I think you split it
you
the
split
same
it
way.
The same
yeah,
way.
You split it.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this, though, question. Let's say somebody wants to utilize the tune, the recording, whether it be a commercial or some other usage, and some people go, I don't want it, and other people do.
Well, that anybody who owns any part of the song can stop it from being used.
Yeah.
And that there's no way around that. You could have one guy who wrote 99% and one wrote 1%. And if that person's 1% is on the ownership of the song, they can turn it down,
right?
As just a owner of the song, if they co-wrote it.
Yes, but publishers, if they someone else
anybody
publishing,
who
the writer can stop it too.
Yeah,
can
they?
Yeah, anybody can stop it. Anybody who has any kind of ownership can.
But I guarantee you, if you're in an electronic ambient project, you
it's all about that.
It's all about that. You're going
to
want.
But
that.
But it would also be good to know. You know, I mean, it's yet another question. Like, hey, if we're lucky enough to get a Nike commercial, are you going to flip out because they use labor in Southeast Asia? You know, whatever.
That would come under. I would imagine, like, how you're going to market yourself, you know? What's going to happen?
I mean, let's say the band doesn't really do anything. It just fizzles. But you know what? You came up with something. Somebody wants to utilize it. Hey, guys, we call it, make some money. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it may seem – in some ways, it may seem silly and presumptuous to even talk about it before anything happens. But what's good is you can actually find out stuff because you might get a crazy reaction to one of these scenarios.
Yeah, that
like,
you weren't expecting.
What?
Yeah.
And you'll actually find out some stuff that you need to know that would come up elsewhere.
You know, I didn't think about
that. It's like getting married, asking if you want to have kids.
Music. I didn't
right.
But you're absolutely right.
Yeah. The kids?
The licensing, I think, is really important. And what – I guess that would come under as to – what's going to happen after the project has finished the CD? You know, you have to find out, you know, does this just live on the CD or is everybody, you know?
I mean, in today's music industry, you should hope that it lives way beyond the CD.
Exactly.
Because licensing and all that stuff is one of the few aspects that you can actually still get paid reasonably for if it's on a good project.
So let me go over this really quick because this is a great list and people out there who want to start a band, I think this is really important.
Step one, don't bother.
Step two, don't do what Mike did.
I think what Andrew said, you know, set your expectations. Find out what the expectations are of the whole project. That's a great way, you know, explain what you want. The other thing is absolutely talk about how the split is going to be, you know, with all monies and what'll happen if you get that out in front. Number three is a clear chain of command who's the leader, who's going to push the thing forward. Number four would be, I would imagine you want to management, you know, I think that would be chain of command. Who's going to manage and kind of do all that. Is there a number four? Did I forget anything?
There's no real reason these days to have a separate manager in the very beginning. I mean, you got to get all the other stuff worked out.
No, that's
out
what I'm
first.
Saying. The management of what you're doing right then and there. Not necessarily management as in artist management.
I see.
Just managing the whole.
You know what?
Yeah, but that's part of setting up the kind of the hierarchy.
I guarantee within two meetings you'll know exactly who the alpha people are, who the follower. I mean, you just put people in a room. And everything will start coming out. It's just nature.
Well, I hope so. And we'll
probably don't – I mean, number five would be don't be afraid to go back on a decision 2 weeks in if you realize it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
It's a great idea.
Don't sign contracts in week one. But if after a month it's going great, you know.
You have to get the band together. Go for lunch. Do something social. See what these people are made of. See how the chemistry goes. Talk. See if people piss each other
off.
We'll
see how they tip their waiters.
Actually, find out what their previous band experience has been.
Yeah, well, that's all kind of was on the phone and talking and that whole thing. That kind of helps weed it down. Well, I'll tell you what, that's, you know, thanks for the advice. I realized I was wrong.
No.
And hopefully I'll be here for the next podcast.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take a break right now. And then when we come back, we're going to, visit with Dusty and talk some more about Mojave Audio and the microphones and that kind of cool stuff. So we'll see you on the other side.
You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Aphex and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And before we visit with Dusty, I just want to let everybody know that, yes, I am going to upgrade my Pro Tools system to 7.4. I have it Woo-hoo. Right here.
Fantastic.
Ooh. All right. What are we at now? 6 what?
6.9. 6.9's been great. I haven't had any problems with 6.9. It's worked flawlessly.
Well, it's time you change that.
So I'm going to upgrade. And anybody have any really quick advice for doing the upgrade?
Just do a get Synchronize Pro by a company called Qdia. I think we've talked about it on this before, like IDEA, but spelled with a Q.
Yeah.
Great program.
$99. First of all, just for backing up and syncing drives, it's by far the fastest I've ever used. It'll scan a 500 gig drive that's full of files in like 25 seconds. But it also does bootable backups onto FireWire drives. Make a bootable backup of your system drive, which you should have anyway in case the hard drive goes down or whatever.
Right.
Just do that before you do your upgrade, because then if anything goes weird, just hook up the drive in startup disk, select it, you're back on 6.9, everything works great.
That's a good idea.
This program also does a compare and copy?
Yeah, it does syncing, it does copying, it does archiving,
it's
it does
really
everything.
Good.
And it'll do all my plugins, all the 6.9
yeah,
plugins
the,
and
the
everything?
The only thing is disk authorizations, disk-based stuff.
Right.
You'll have to re-enter serial code.
Yeah, everything is iLocked, I believe. So
then, yeah.
I'm good.
Oh, absolutely.
I'm
no,
good to go.
It is. It's as if it's booting off the internal.
Well, I'm going to do that.
Yeah,
great.
It's really
Thanks.
Good.
All right. Well, we are honored to have Dusty Wakeman from Mojave Audio. And Dusty, why don't you tell us a little bit about Mojave Audio and how you got involved with them? And actually, even before that, a little bit of your background, because I know you've worked in several studios and you've kind of done a little bit of everything. So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, my background, you know, I still kind of look at myself as a bass player more than anything else that got into all this other stuff along the way. But I've owned a studio called Mad Dog Studios for 28 years now. And, you know, worked for pretty much the last three decades as an engineer and producer and bass player. So a couple of years – well, when the way I got hooked up with Mojave, when the Royer Ribbon mics first came out, I read an article, one of the magazines about them, and noticed they were in Burbank. So I called them up and said, hey, I'm in Burbank. I'd love to try out some of these mics. And, you know, fell in love with them. I just worked with a producer named Craig Street on a Michelle and Dago cello album. And I hadn't – even touched ribbon mics for years, except for occasional horn dates at Capitol. You know, we'd break out the RCAs, but they were kind of out of my consciousness. And he had brought in a bunch of Coles, and I just kind of fell in love with them. It's like, God, I forgot how good these things sound. You know, you do this stuff for so long, you forget things that you know, and then you get reminded of them, and it's right. Like, oh, yeah, I used to do that like 20 years ago. That's a cool idea. Like the NS-10 woofer for the kick drum. You know, I learned that when I was 20, and it was a little Radio Shack. Woofer, one of those funny shaped ones, you know, elliptical. But I fell in love with the Royer mics, and I got to know those people, and, you know, then I'd be doing a big band. I bought some, but I'd be doing a big band date, and I'd be like, hey, can I borrow 20 mics for 3 days? They'd be like, yeah, sure, you know.
Really?
So I got to know these people. I got to be friends with them and developed a relationship, especially John over there. And I got into the kid business late in the game. I've got a 9.5 and a 4.5-year-old. And right before – my daughter's adopted from China. And I hope she's not listening because she didn't know that yet. But Sonny, go to sleep, honey. I'll explain it when I get home. Like the night before we were going to China to pick up my daughter, I got in this big conversation with John from Royer. And I was just really kind of looking for a lifestyle change. I was just burnt at 25 years of making records nonstop. Loved doing it, but the industry was changing. You know, those big producer advances were kind of becoming scarcer and scarcer. And I was just really tired of the hours, and I kind of missed analog and, you know, was not a happy camper at that point. And was kind of looking around for the things I could do. And it's funny you were talking about Guitar Center, because my first 3 years in L.A. were at West L.A. Music, 1977 to 1980. So I lived that too. So I have kind of a pro audio background and have maintained a lot of those relationships. And he brought in – Eddie Kramer was working in my studio. John brought in one of the prototypes for the Mojave MA-200, one of the kit mics. I don't know if you guys know about the kits, but David Royer had published this article in Tape Op in 2001 on how to take a Marshall mic, one of the Chinese mics, and do a $300 tube mod on it and turn it into a really nice-sounding mic. So that's what created the demand for these. that was so, the response was so big that they, the Warrior folks said, you know, we should actually make these mics. So it was just a perfect, you know, one of those things that falls into your lap. I was kind of looking for something else to do, and they were looking for somebody to take over this thing and really start it up and run with it. And they were in Burbank, and, you know, the Burbank is the center of the universe as we know it. So it just worked out, and it's 2.5 years later, and I'm having a great time.
And what is your position with them?
I'm president of the company, for what that's worth. It's pretty much me and David, and that's it. So, you know, but I do pretty much everything, which I enjoy. You know, I enjoy using other parts of my brain besides just the recording part from time to time.
Well, before we move on with talking more about the microphones, Andrew, I know you really like
– I love them.
Why don't you talk a little bit about the microphone and why you like your Mojave?
Well, actually, the first time I'd ever heard one, I'd already heard about them from Ryan Hewitt, who's another engineer I've done a lot of stuff with, who was hooked up with you guys really early on. And I'd heard about them, but I hadn't heard one yet. And then Bobby actually got a demo unit from somebody. And so I went over to his place, and we were listening to the microphone, and he had – we listened to – I mean, just sort of whatever mics he had. So we had a U47, Bobby's beautiful U47. We had a 414. We just had a bunch of different microphones just to see what the characteristic of this thing was. And among other things, the top end blew away every microphone in the place, including the 47. It was just wide open. We recorded a shaker, and it was as if all the other microphones had towels on them. It was incredible. And then just started using them in more and more situations. And I mean, I think it was the next day that I came and bought a pair and used them as overheads in that day on some drums. And I just love them. They work on everything. Just did a percussion date with him on a record I recorded last year. We were recording acoustic guitar, and we put up a 251, which, you know, it's hard to argue with that sometimes, a U67, a U87, a C37A, and a Mojave, and just recorded acoustic guitar with all of these mics, and we chose the Mojave. And that's what's on acoustic on the entire record.
Is it a pencil mic, or is it like a tube?
No, it's a large diaphragm tube condenser.
And Dusty, what makes them so good? I mean, you know, everybody who I've talked about Mojave microphones,
and just
love them.
To back up a little bit, the reason I was so excited is because I fell in love with this microphone, and then they told me how much they were going to sell for, and it was like, this is insane to be able to buy a microphone that sounds this good for this money. You're going to sell boatloads. Can I play? You know?
I mean, what's street price on them now?
It's $9.95. Our dealers don't discount the mics. It's like it's $9.95
right,
wherever you get it, whoever you get it from.
Which it's
because
insane.
It's such a phenomenal deal. It's like
yeah.
They don't need to start, you know, just blowing those things out.
Well, it blows away mics that cost 10 times as much.
I know. Well, I've got a beautiful U47 and, you know, a pair of 67s and a C12 and, you know.
And it's not like you stop using those.
Yeah.
But
it's just another great mic.
Yeah.
But the great thing for a studio owner is you can afford to have four of them. You know, you can have a pair for overheads and one on the vocal and
it'll
one
be
on the
a pair that
guitar.
Sounds the same because they're new.
Does right. it work with 48 volts or do you need your own power supply?
It's got its own power supply. It comes with a complete kit. They're fixed cardioid. One reason they sound so good is there's nothing to them. They're dead simple. You know, it's a capsule and a couple of components, a big Jensen transformer, and a nice American new old stock tube. It's a sub-miniature called a 5840 that David discovered when he was in the Navy. He was a radar guy in the Navy. And he loves this tube. It's the same tube that's in the Royer 122V, the tube ribbon mic.
And they and is that what gives it the bite, the top end?
I guess you know it's bright, but it's not. There's no harshness there. It's really
right.
open.
No, and, it's incredibly
natural. And it's
natural.
Really what I've learned from working with David, which has just been a trip. We can talk about that a little bit. But I
absolutely
you know, I learn every day from being around David Royer. But it's all about the circuitry. It's not about the capsules. You know, the capsules are fine. He's been screwing around with these Chinese mic capsules for 20 years now and has made some legendary microphones and by people like Mutt Lang and Bob Clearmountain that use these same capsules that are, you know, U67 knockoffs. But it's the electronics. The reason all the cheap Chinese mics sound bad is they have really bad electronics in them.
So the capsules are good, but the electronics are...
Exactly.
And specifically, are we talking electronics like the capacitors or and the transistors or
right.
the way the circuit
and
is designed?
The transformers.
The transformers?
Yeah, just really bad components. That's why he was able to take this Marshall microphone that you can buy for a couple hundred bucks and turn it into something that sounds really great for $300, $350. We still get requests for these, the kits that they made every day. You know, we don't do them anymore because you don't want to be in the kit business on any sort of a scale. You know, you spend all your time
support.
Yeah, you spend all your time trying to figure out why the guy's mic isn't working.
So how was it working with David Royer and
well, David's one of those guys that is, you know, he's from another world. He's, you know, I tell people David's a Vulcan, you know. He's just he's got a genius for microphones. You know, he could sit here, and in fact, if you want me to bring him over sometime, I will.
Oh, absolutely.
He can tell you every component ever used in any Neumann microphone, pre-Neumann, just the whole entire history. It's all in his brain. And when it comes to microphones, I can go to him and go, David, you remember that little diagram you sketched out for me about 6 months ago for whatever? And he'll know where it is. You know, he's also the guy, it's like, David, did you pay your car insurance? You know, did you remember to renew your driver's license? There's somebody on the phone. You know, he's just the absent-minded professor, but he's got an absolute genius for microphones. And it's really funny. He loves classical music and loves like Eastern European folk music, but he's kind of appalled at the things we all do with his microphones for, you know, rock and roll and country and things like that. It's like, why would you want to stick this ribbon mic up on a loud guitar amp? You know, it's not what I designed it for. It's like, but that's what it's good for. It's what we all love it for.
So tell us a little bit more. We've heard about the 200, you know, because that's the one that Andrew was talking about. But what about like your 100, the condenser mic?
The 100 is a small diaphragm tube condenser. And like, to back up a little bit, the 200 is a fixed cardioid. There's no pattern selector. There's no attenuator. There's no high pass filter. There's nothing. It's just dead simple, which is part of why we can make it sound so good and sell it for that price, because all those things cost money. Also, all those things degrade the signal because the audio is going through all those things, even if they're not engaged.
Right.
In most circuits.
But I just want to jump in and say it's the only large diaphragm mic I've used ever that doesn't need a pad. Because most of them will just start blowing themselves up unless you can stick a pad on there. And I've never needed to. And they're not low output microphones.
No,
but they can
output.
Handle
they can take
anything.
SPL?
Yeah. I mean, you may need to crank your mic pre down quite a bit, but there's no distortion coming out of that mic.
Or
no
you might
what
need
you
to put a pad in front of your mic pre if you have a mic pre that can't take it. But it's not the mic that's crapping out. It's something downstream.
And what would you say the mic's best for? Vocals, percussion?
Vocals, drum overheads, acoustic guitars, those three things. I mean, it's just you use it anywhere you'd use a U67. But those three things it really excels at. It's the MA200.
It really is phenomenal. That's the mic that I mean, I've heard it used on a bunch of studio stuff, but I think the first time Stevie had actually heard it was at that NAMM show, and just instantly, even just hearing it on headphones, he just knew it was special, you know. Yeah. He just latched onto it.
What about the 100?
The 100 is a small diaphragm tube condenser, and it has interchangeable capsules, so you get omni and cardioid.
And is that also a 48 volt, or is it a special power supply?
It's tube. It's got its own power supply, and it retails for $795. It sells for $795.
Wow.
And now we've got the new 100 SP, it's called, which is the stereo pair. There's two of them in one case with a dual power supply. So as soon as anybody saw the single ones, it's like, you got to make a stereo pair. Well, we have it finally. And those things are amazing. A lot of engineers, especially younger engineers, don't think of putting something like a small diaphragm tube condenser on a tom or a snare drum, but right. They're phenomenal.
Yeah,
like it's the ultimate
the
tom mic. This thing will take 145 dB without crapping out, and just, you know, a lot of older engineers know about that, but a lot of young guys that are like, you got to put dynamics on toms. You can't put a
well, and they haven't been allowed to put a tube mic anywhere near a drum
exactly.
kit.
Right. And these are like, they're awesome on it. Or
really?
For loud guitar amps, put one of those and a Royer ribbon next to each other. And, you know, forget about it. It's great.
What new stuff did you guys show at NAMM this year? Because there was...
Well, the new thing that we showed, which we'll be shipping around June 1st, is our first solid-state mic. And that's the MA201 FET. And it'll sell for $695. And, you know, it's just crazy. It sounds almost as good as the MA200 at $695.
Why don't you explain what a FET microphone is for people that may not know what
Well, I'm not a designer, but FET stands for field effect transistor. And you use it instead of the tube in the circuit. And one of you guys might be able to expand on that more.
So that uses phantom power then?
Yeah, it uses phantom power.
As opposed to a separate tube power supply.
And one thing, you know, I've learned, which I should have known this from being an engineer for 30 years, but, you know, when you go to studios, you can't really trust the 48-volt power supply.
Right.
You should always measure it if you're somewhere else. You know, you just get a little simple multimeter and measure it.
Yeah, because the original spec was like anywhere from 20 to 60 volts or something. But then it sort of got standardized at 48. And most manufacturers are expecting 48. And if they don't get it, it's
your mics
not
aren't
good.
Happy. They're
it
not going to perform up to spec.
A lot of them aren't 48. They're, you know, 20.
Yeah,
30.
Right.
Well,
right. Yeah.
Look at USB audio interfaces with, you know, phantom power. A lot of those audio interfaces aren't putting out 48 volts.
Oh, no way.
So you can go buy a standalone phantom power supply for not too much money and ensure that you've got 48 volts for all your microphones, and all of a sudden you're a better engineer.
What's the noise floor on all the mics?
I don't know.
I mean,
they're super quiet.
I don't have the spec. David will be really mad at me for not having that memorized, but, you know, I've given up trying to memorize.
The reason why I'm asking is I'm thinking a little outside the box other than music, but we do things called Foley. Which is not really great for microphones as far as atmospheric, because there's dust in the air and all that.
Right.
But you're smashing things, and a lot of times you need super clean because you're whipping up the gain quite high.
No,
but you need high output.
They're super clean. The 100 would be really cool for Foley. I know pretty much everybody uses the same, what is it, Sennheiser for Foley microphone.
Well, it used to be shotguns, but that's kind of gotten out away now. I mean, they use shotguns because they don't want to hear the room.
Right.
But there's always several other mics in the room that they're using to get something bigger because the shotgun's never going to have that womp, you know.
I've seen 87s in.
I've still seen 87s, 414s. I've seen all
these. They would definitely work.
Yeah.
Super
the noise
quiet.
Is really low. They're really quiet.
You know, in any place you'd use like a 451, this would blow it away. Mm. I mean, we did some testing at the studio, in my studio, of like tambourine and the key test and stuff like that. And it was just, and I love 451s. I've got four of them, but it was just kind of silly, the difference. It was like taking a sock off it or something.
Let's talk a little bit about the culture of Mojave Audio, because a couple things, even before I met you, I used to notice your ads that you would run in the different trade magazines, and they always seemed like you never talked down to your potential customers out there. You seem like you always took everybody pretty serious. And then when you go to your website, you've got just some really fantastic recording tips and different things on your website. Tell us a little about, you know, how your attitude towards your customer just seems to be a little bit more sincere, I guess, or genuine.
Well, the Mojave mics are kind of like, they're the people's mics. You know, they're affordable. Our whole thing is making really nice sounding mics that people can actually afford and not be so precious with. You know, they
right.
can, you, so that they can actually take a microphone and like a MA-100 and stick it up on a guitar amp or on a tube and not be scared to death. Because as a studio owner, there was a lot of mics that were, you know, not available for certain clients for certain uses. It's like, you know, I would tell my guys, don't just automatically get the 67s out and put them on old drum overheads.
Yeah.
You know, if it's somebody that's going to really appreciate them and it's going to be useful, great.
Right.
But there's plenty of other mics. You don't have to like drag them out every time just to show them off, you know. But with the Mojave mics, it's like, you know, they're affordable. You can do stuff like that and not be scared of it. So it's really, you know, we're kind of like geared toward the tape op crowd, you know, people that are just really into great sound that don't
right.
have a lot of money.
I mean, I was impressed, like I said, by the website. You have photos of mic placement and things like that. I mean, that's just great education, even if you're not going to buy a microphone. I hate to say that.
Well, I appreciate hearing that. I mean, for me, I'm not like a sales guy.
Right.
You know, I'm an engineer and a bass player that happens to be doing this gig, and I love doing it. So that's really the only way I can relate to people is through the actual use of them. I don't really know how to give a PowerPoint presentation about demographics or sales or any of that stuff.
And I will say one thing, because Dusty probably won't mention it, but he's not just like a part-time kind of bass player or anything. Dusty was actually going to be our guest 2 weeks ago, but had to postpone because he was in rehearsals to be on The Tonight Show the next night playing bass.
And who'd you play with?
A guy named Jim Lauderdale, who's an amazing country bluegrass artist that I've worked with. I produced two of his albums, and have toured the world with him. He just won his second Grammy,
wow,
the last Grammys. Not a lot of people know him in L.A. I mean, he's a big cult star, but he's been a really, really successful country songwriter. And he's always like on somebody's album, he's the edgy guy, you know, Jim stuff. But he's an amazing singer. Plus, that band was James Burton on guitar and Al Perkins on steel. So it was a thrill for me to play with those guys.
It sounded amazing.
Cool.
It really did sound amazing.
Well, you know, I walk in there. This is the beauty of Burbank again. The guy that mixes that show, I had made an album with Jim in the desert like 10 years ago. He was the staff engineer for Les Mobiles.
Really?
So he came up and said, hey, I made an album with you guys 10 years ago. So we got a little extra special treatment.
That's pretty cool.
Got to go in the booth and actually listen to it.
And Dusty had told me, you know, I'm going to be on the show, but you probably won't see me at all. Meanwhile, he was standing right over Jim's shoulder, and you got plenty of FaceTime. It was actually really good.
See, I know where to stand. You know, you watch the monitor, make sure your head's kind of in there over his shoulder.
But of course, you had this look on your face the whole time of, no one's watching me. I don't care.
No, you know, people always say that, and it's like, I'm just in the zone. I'm just trying not to screw up. You know? It's like, I'll smile when I'm done and I didn't make any major clams and embarrass myself. I'll be smiling then. I'm just concentrating.
It sounded really good.
Yeah, I thought it sounded good too. And yeah, it's still online. I don't know how long they keep them on there, but you can go to NBC.com and then to the night show. And I think it was March 18th or March 19th.
It was on a Wednesday.
Yeah, it was March 19th.
Nice. That was pretty cool.
And the other good thing about that was the Tonight Show, it's taped in Burbank.
Yeah, yeah. And you're done by 5. It's great. Don Cuco's across the street having margaritas by 6 o'clock, listening to James Burton talk about Elvis.
Wow.
That's great. Well, what's next for Mojave Audio? You've got this, the FET microphone coming out.
That's coming out, and I really think that's going to be a popular microphone because, you know, even for a lot of people, $1,000 is still a lot of microphone, you know. And we were talking earlier before we actually started rolling, but all the people out there that play music for fun, like our biggest dealer is Sweetwater.
Right.
And that's their clientele. I mean, their people, they sell to a lot of pros because they're awesome. But, you know, a lot of their clientele are doctors and lawyers and accountants that have these bitchin' home studios that have disposable income, you know, and that's what they do. They don't work on cars or play on softball teams. They record and they have bands and play. And the United States is full of them out there. So, you know, a lot of those people are our clientele as well, not just the pros. So I think at $695, this microphone's going to make a lot of people happy.
Wow, $695.
Yeah.
That's
and,
great.
You know, I just look at my job. I'm just turning people on to something cool. You know, I'm not trying to sell anybody anything. You can't make a perfect microphone for everybody, you know, but a lot of people like this, and I get turned on by the enthusiasm of people like Andrew that are professionals saying, this is a really good mic. It's like, yeah, so let's spread the love.
Now, let me ask you, you know, you've got a great microphone, you've got a really great ethic, a really good culture that you've put together with the whole Mojave Audio. How do you feel about some of these other mic companies that are coming up and doing the cheap Chinese and they're buying actual, you know, OEM microphones from, you know, from over there and slapping their name on it and then trying to put all this hype about how awesome their microphones are when they're just nothing but,
you know, just
smoke and mirrors.
I've got mixed emotions about it. I mean, the fact that you can buy anything that $150 that sounds halfway decent is pretty cool, you know, even though I wouldn't want one. And, you know, as soon as you kind of learn, they're starter microphones. They're kind of almost disposable.
Right.
So for that, it's like, you know, there's a place for them in the marketplace.
They're good to shoot guns at.
Yeah, exactly. You can hammer nails.
No, really.
No, with Scott?
In the final, I record sound effects, so
right.
I'm not going to put the Sheps and the Neumanns out there, you know.
So it's the old joke. How did it sound great? It sounded great for a second.
Yeah, the ribbon mic on the kick drum.
Right, it sounded wonderful for the first hit. Right. So, you know, there's a place for them, but, you know, if you like, I'll tell you a little of the history of Chinese microphones.
Absolutely.
That I've discovered. So, about 40 years ago, China was totally dependent on Russia, on the Soviet Union, for everything. They bought everything from Mother Russia. And as their relationship started getting a little rocky, they started realizing, we got to start making our own stuff. And this was across the board in every industry. So they went to their comrades in East Germany who invented condenser microphones and said, come hook us up. So the East German engineers, and I'm not sure who they were, if it was the Gefell guys or who it was, but it was the guys, came over and they started two factories, one in Beijing and one in Shanghai. And they've been making these capsules that are knockoffs of Neumann's, you know, KK67 capsules for 40 years now. So the Chinese are really good. You know, you show them how to do something, they're really good at it. They'll just do it very well again and again. David started fooling around with these mics as the veil of China started to get lifted and people started finding them and bringing them in. David started playing around with them because, you know, that's what he does 24 hours a day and discovered that, hey, these capsules are fine. So he started making microphones one at a time in his garage in Fullerton under the name Mojave Audio way before Royer existed. He was just a one-man mic shop. So there's people like Mutt Lang and Bob Clearmountain that have these mics. We call them the pipe bombs because that's what they look like. But they've got the same capsule in them that we have, and they're basically the same circuit as the MA200 that he's evolved over time. Just very simple. But, you know, we put the money where it counts. I mean, we spend $40 per mic on transformer, which is probably what it costs to make one of the Chinese mics or less.
Right.
You know, our tubes cost a lot. We spend over $10 per shock mount just to make a decent shock mount. And let me tell you, it's easier to make microphones than it is to make a decent shock mount. I've been there. In fact, I had to just replace Andrew's because Andrew had some early ones. It's been kind of a journey of discovery for me to learn how to make decent shock mounts. But, like I said, David and I have actually been over there. We actually went to China when I came on board and we were shopping around. It's like, okay, let's find out who the best manufacturer. Cause there's all these secrecy and there's all these middlemen floating around there.
Right.
You know, oh, I'll make them for you at my factory. Well, they're all being made at the same place in Beijing. You know, everybody from, Manly, their cheaper microphone. The list goes on and on of all these mics and they're all made at the same place. What I discovered was the factory in Shanghai was a little smaller, but it was much more modern. And they have an American representative. So we have somebody but it is part of the family that we can deal with. So it makes it really easy for us to deal directly with the manager and the chief engineer. The chief engineer over there is, you know, a brilliant man. He knows what he's doing. And him and David really had a meeting of the minds. So we actually went there and checked it out. And they've worked really hard to deliver something that we can feel good about.
So you get your capsules and then you come over and you add your electronics.
No, what we do is we send the transformers and the tubes and the shock mount parts over there. And for the FET, we send the FETs and the transistors.
I got you.
Over there. They manufacture them, send them back. We burn them all in for 24 hours. David listens to every single microphone.
Wow.
He rejects very few. They've been really consistent, but you know, once in a while there's one that a lot of times it's a part we send over. It's the tube or the transformer that's bad.
Wow.
We have to replace. But he listens to every single mic.
So like if somebody wanted to get a matched pair?
We do that. Well, yeah, we match them there. We've got a little rig set up there, a little chamber, you know, with the computer on it. Audio precision?
Yeah.
Rig set up where we can do matching.
Wow.
So we do that.
Well, that's pretty awesome, man. It sounds like you guys have done your homework and you go in there and that's why your quality is as high as it is.
Yeah, and we're kind of in the middle. We're kind of doing something nobody else is doing, which is taking the best of both worlds. It's really a hybrid because we're putting the expensive parts where you can hear them, where they make a difference.
Well, you know, $1,000 is really, that's a great, you know, entry big time microphone. It really is. There's a couple of choices that you can get out there, but apparently the only choice you want to make is the Mavi Audio microphone because, for all the reasons that you said. I've heard your microphone at the NAMM booth and I noticed the bite. You know, that's about the only thing you can notice over at NAMM show.
Right. It's got a bite, but it's a good bite.
Yeah, exactly.
It's that expensive bite.
Exactly.
It has like the 67 has. It's not harsh.
Yeah, it's great.
The price is a little deceptive. I mean, it could have been priced higher and people would have taken it seriously. I mean, anybody who hears it takes it seriously. But at that price point, you might not realize you should be comparing it with mics that cost $5,000 and $6,000.
Yeah, well, I mean, listening to it that night with Bobby and when I'd heard good stuff about it. But you always start in with, okay, it's a mic that costs this much. And that's
right.
It sets your expectations. And then it sort of colors your judgment for a second. But this – it's that good that there was no question like this was holding up against a $10,000 mic, a $3,500 new mic. You know, it's great. That's They're great cool. microphones.
Well, you know, happiness is a mic closet full of great mics to choose from for a project.
I mean, and no mic does everything for you. But because we've talked about it before on the podcast about, okay, if you're only going to have one mic, well, the Mojave is definitely one that you would consider if you're only going to have one because it can cover a lot of ground. I mean, there's some stuff it's not right for, but it's right for a lot of the big stuff.
How's the low end on it?
It's phenomenal.
It's really extended. We have problems sometimes because people aren't used to that extended of a low end. And they'll be using it like in a voiceover booth, and they'll be like, there's something wrong with it, because every time we close the door, we hear this really ugly noise.
Yeah, it's the most susceptible to like wind thump of any mic that size that you
use. And that's because the low end is so extended. It's flat down to like 25 hertz. You know, so if you have a thump, it's going to make a big spike, and that's going to crap out your mic pre.
So,
but people haven't heard that before. It's like my 414 doesn't do that. There's something wrong with this mic.
But if you put your hand over with air, like, you know, hand in front of the mic, is it that susceptible?
No, more so
than a 67 or an 87. Yeah.
No, but where you'll notice it is exactly like you said, with a small booth, when you open and close the door, that wind movement is enough that it really thumps the Mojave because it's putting it out. As opposed to most mics, which kind of don't even respond.
Well, you know, the one thing I noticed just on your pictures on your website is you can put some air in between you and the microphone. You know,
because of the low end, you're not trying to get the proximity effect just to get low end. It's there anyway.
Well, you know, something I've been on kind of a little mission about as far as recording guitars. This is just a personal thing, but I read Joe Ciccarelli say this once in an interview. You know, somebody along the way decided the only way to record a guitar amp was to stick a 57 like up on the grill. And there's, you know, a valid spot for that. But a lot of the classic rock stuff that we love, Beatles and Stones, that was a 67 like 2 feet away, you know, and it was 2 feet away because they couldn't put it any closer. The consoles wouldn't, the preamps wouldn't handle it. So that was as close as they could get it. But that's a great sound.
Right.
And the MA200 is wonderful for that. You know, if you're doing like a, you know, a Gretsch guitar through an open back deluxe. You know, you put it a couple of feet away. If you're in a good room, it'll sound fabulous.
And you should actually, Scott, try the the FET one for location recording, so you don't need the tube power supply. It just runs on phantom power.
But I'm also
it's the same capsule, right?
Right.
It just doesn't have the tube circuitry. So
the other thing
different.
I'm gonna really be pushing with the FET is for people to use it on a kick drum, because it's like, you know, everybody loves a 47 FET on kick drum, and this will do kind of give you the similar kind of effect for
the new one?
Yeah, the solid state one.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people can't afford a 47 FET for their kick drum, but this is a good kind of cheap substitute for that. It works really well.
Well, Dusty, we're going to have to wrap things up right now. But
oh, man, I'm just getting started.
Well, you can keep going.
That's okay. Right. So we're going to wrap it up.
I'm going to get on my phone and start calling people. Hey.
No, but thank you so much for joining us here and telling us a little bit about it. And, you know, I really encourage people to go to MojaveAudio.com because even if you – well, obviously, if you're looking for a really great microphone or this is going to be your first expensive microphone, the MA200 is the one you want to get. And even if you're not right now in the market to get that microphone, go to their website because they've got a lot of really great little tips on recording different instruments, and they have photos, and it's a great site.
I just put up a new video of a gamelan. You know what a gamelan is? You know, the Indonesian orchestra ceremony thing. A gamelan that was recorded at the Red Cat Theater with three MA100s. And it's got video with it. I was able to get the video and go in iMovie and match it up.
That's cool.
Really cool. It's amazing recording.
Yeah, so there's definitely some great stuff.
There's always
new
stuff on there. I'm always trying to find stuff to put on that's not just the normal, you know, guitar-based drum stuff. Yeah. Although we've got a lot of that, too.
And we'll definitely take you up on bringing David Royer here at some point.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
to hear
you bet.
Some of those stories.
You bet.
That'll be great.
You bet.
All right. Well, we're going to be wrapping it up. And before we go, just want to say, anybody working on anything they can talk about?
Of course not.
That's a big no.
I will say that we're working on an interactive project.
Oh.
We've experimented with, I don't know how many different mastering chains because we have to be able to deliver some of the stuff at a really low sample rate.
Right.
And I'm pleased to report that in the 2 weeks since the last one of these podcasts we've done, I think we finally found our chain.
Oh, that's good.
Now, the one song that we used as the test for all these different chains, I won't cry if I never hear it again my entire life. I've heard it a trillion times. But it is possible to make some things sound good at 11K. I mean, understanding it's never going to sound incredible. But it's an act. I would now say it's officially an art form to bring the most out of a low sample rate because it's not just about taking something at 44.1 or 48 and exporting it at 11K. It's just not that easy.
Wow.
You have to sort of work around what you know all the deficiencies are going to be. And there actually is a way to do it that sounds pretty musical. And I'm glad we found it because it was driving me crazy.
Do we get to know what it is or only that it exists?
You know what? Interactive clients are so secretive. as soon as it comes out, as soon as the game comes out, it'll be totally public knowledge. But until it comes out, I'm sure in the 4-inch pile of papers they have you sign, half of them are non-disclosures of some sort or another. So we just, it's just easier not to talk about anything.
All right. For a future podcast, then.
That's definitely. Right. Oh, we always do. We always recap when the stuff actually comes out. We say, you know that thing we weren't allowed to talk about? It was.
Yeah. I don't know if you know, I zipped up to Seattle for a day and a half.
You did?
I did.
I actually
got invited by Microsoft to partake. Something I can't talk about, but I'm so looking forward to it. There's something new. There's something very cool. Something new, something no one's ever seen that they're working on. They want us to do the audio side of it.
Zune 2, right?
Zune 3.
Coming soon or coming eventually?
It's within the next year or two.
Wow.
Okay. Soon and eventually.
Well, an album I mixed last year is actually coming out very soon. This band, Blood Red Shoes, and it's coming out everywhere except the States
at the moment.
But it's out in a week or so. You can get it off of Amazon UK, or they've also pressed up vinyl, and you can get it pretty cheap through some of the online sites in the UK, and they'll ship it.
And what's the name of that band again?
Blood Red Shoes. It is a duo, drums and guitar, and it's very loud and very fun.
Cool. I'm going to look forward to that. I'll have to pick that one up. Well, hey, guys, I want to tell you that this is show number 49.
Wow.
Which means show number 50 is our next podcast.
Does that mean we have to bring what, silver?
The next show number 49.
Is diamond?
Yeah. 49 will be 49 again.
And I have a very important announcement, because by the time this is posted, it'll be old news. But in front of me right now, I've got a copy of the CD. That Martin Page.
No, Mike.
Really?
Has been trying to put out. Actually, he's finally going to come out with it. And for our next podcast, I just want to let everybody know that we're actually going to be doing a playback. And Martin, he'll be back. And we're going to play a couple tunes off the CD.
Excellent.
And we're going to celebrate the 50th.
Will there be food?
There'll be food. There'll be people. We're going to have, you know.
Any girls?
An audience. We're going to do another live audience because that was kind of fun. So that's just to tease the next show. So
Congratulations, Martin.
All right.
Yeah.
So if you've made it through 49 shows, the 50th will be worth your while. I guarantee you that.
Cool.
All right, gang. Well, hey, we're going to wrap it up now. And I want to thank everybody for listening. And if you have any comments or questions, you can reach us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. And if you have any questions for Dusty, you can reach him email at
www.mojaveaudio.com.
And will they get your email address or the email address?
Yeah, there you could sales or info or Dusty, any of those at mojaveaudio.com will work.
Great.
They all come to the same place.
Yeah, so give those guys a call if you're interested. You will not waste your money. It's a great investment. And the good thing about microphones is, you know, you take care of them, they're going to last you a long, long time.
And if not, you'll have Dusty's email address.
So that's right.
All right. Well, for myself and all the guys, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez with Rob Arbatier, Scott Gershon, Martin Page, Andrew Schefts, and Bobby Summerfield. The program is produced by April Mastropaolo and uses Apex's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.